So I don't know where Ruben is.
Well, anyway.
Oh. Okay, that's Diane.
So let's... I read The Moral Philosopher. It's pretty good.
What's that?
That essay, The Moral Philosopher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that what we're still talking about, or are we past that?
We finished it. What am I doing? I can't see what I'm doing here. Okay. We finished that last week. Let me recap, though, where we are. So we're talking about, of course, The Will to Believe, which, as I keep on saying, I think is his best his best work. And it's really just a collection of essays. We're looking at the seven that have to do with his arguments for religious belief, and, you know, which is the main topic, of course. And I have divided those various arguments into five arguments altogether. And we started the fifth one last time, but let me just kind of recap. The first three strike me as being more closely related to the pragmatic theory of truth. You know, the first one, as I characterize it, is an updated version of Pascal's wager argument. That's where all of this stuff on the board came from, the living option, the force, the meritorious, and seeking truth, as opposed to being hyper about possibly making a mistake. And of course, the rewards are great, even if you take the chance, right? That's the essence of the wager that you're making. The second one was the idea that that belief is not just something in reaction to the world that never changes, but belief can also affect the world. It can affect the world. It can affect changes within the world. And of course, the memorable analogy he gives there is, you know, jumping across a chasm. If you actually believe you can do it, that's going to improve your chances. So that was in some sense, belief can actually influence how things are. We talked a lot about exactly what that means. The third argument, I think, is the, I classified it in my notes as the, hey Ruben,
hello,
as the volitional argument. And that one is the most useful, I think, of the five arguments, because it gives us some clue as to what he means in his very, well, remember, I kept on saying when we were going over the pragmatic theory, how he says one thing over here and something else over here, and the whole thing is just kind of vague. That third argument, though, for belief, really does help a lot. Helps us a lot to understand the pragmatic theory, at least how he was thinking of it, because the idea is that that's over there on the board. The idea there is that, sure, the empiricists are correct that knowledge comes from perception, from experience, and yes, the rationalists are also correct that certain kinds of knowledge, namely mathematical knowledge, deductive types of things, come from reason alone, thinking, as we have up there. But there's a third source of knowledge, and that is your feeling, your emotions. What did he call it? Willing. Your emotions also, so he claims, have a role to play in the acquisition and validation of knowledge. It's a triumvirate, not a duumvirate, if you know what I mean. And that is really what I think clarifies a lot what he means by the pragmatic theory of truth, right? I mean, something is true if it has, in a broad sense, useful effects. Well, what are those useful effects? Well, they can be perceptual kinds of things that we confirm as a result of doing experiments and all that. They can be purely conceptual effects, right, in the case of mathematics. But they can also be effects in the area of emotions and willing and feeling and all that sort of thing. And for James, that is the problem with a strict positivism that would exclude that sort of stuff and focus only on perception and thinking, because he would want to include this third category as well. I wish he had said that back in Pragmatism and some of the other works, but at least now we have this argument in The Will to Believe that helps us understand exactly what he means by this, practical effects. Well, it means experiential effects, it means rational effects, but it also means volitional and emotional types of effects. And that's why the circle that represents what can and can't be known, that one over there, is so much bigger than any of the other circles, because he wants to say that what counts as evidence is something more than a really very strict positivist would say counts as evidence. So that, for my money, is the most interesting argument he has, mainly because it helps us flesh out what he means by the pragmatic theory of truth. The fourth, anyway, those first three arguments all sort of align to one degree or another, I think, with that pragmatic theory of truth. The fourth argument that we went over last time, which I called the C.S. Lewis / Riley Williams argument, remember, is the moral argument. It's to say that we all have some sort of intuitions. We all have sort of moral intuitions. And where do those moral intuitions come from? Well, he takes a very, remember, kind of a Hobbesian view that you look out in the world, well, you don't see good, you don't see right or just or whatever out there. You just see facts, you don't see values. So values have to come from some sort of will. And yet we have a sense that values are absolute. So therefore, there must be some sort of absolute will that is setting up those values in the first place, that would account for their absoluteness, and that, of course, would be a divine will. But the idea is, as I say, very Hobbesian, that you don't have something that's good independent of somebody willing it, and yet it's not the case that you will one thing, and so forth and so on. I will something else. Because there's, as it were, an absolute willer out there whose will supersedes any finite will. And the sense that we have that morals are independent of our own volition is what leads us to that postulate of a divine will whose will supersedes our own partial will. So that's the C.S. Lewis, Riley Williams argument that we went over last time. So now we're on to the fifth argument. Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
As I said, I went through his moral philosophy essay, which is pretty good, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
And, from a different angle on the divine aspect. So he says, humans do not need the divine in order to have a moral universe here on Earth, right? That you don't. He doesn't say God has to exist again. He's not trying to prove, right? But the way he puts it was, he thinks God is good, at least for the philosopher, because contemplation of a God, in a merely human world without a God, the appeal to our moral energy falls short of its maximum stimulating power that the infinite perspective opens up out.
Okay.
So basically, you can come up with rational arguments for why humans have the morals that they do, with or without God, but God makes it much more stimulating to think of the infinite beyond just what humans can do.
Well, once again, I think it's a matter of, this is not a proof in the sense of a medieval cosmological argument or something like that, but I think the sense of it is, it tips the scale in the direction of theism. The fact that we have this moral sense, as it were, and also the fact that morals don't come into being except as a result of a will, tips the scale in favor of theism. of a divine will.
I interpret it as a pretty modest tilt, because he spends a lot of time talking about how humans can, where do humans come, you know, how do humans do what they do, right? They don't, and how do they decide? Right? Talks a long time about how should you decide which ones win, you know, triumph over the others.
Mm-hmm.
And then toward the end, he says, yeah, this idea of a God sure makes it more interesting.
Well, it makes it more compelling is the thing. I mean, you know, I read the, I removed my bookmark that I had in here.
Well, he hints at how it's
toward,
handy,
it is toward the end.
You know, that the divine offers an opportunity for an afterlife. Let me just have one more quote here, Don, if you don't mind.
No, that's fine.
Even if there were no physical traditional grounds for believing in a God, is that God calling me now?
He's saying,
blasphemy.
Don is right.
There's a question.
You are divine intervention.
Yeah, maybe I can make a skit, you know, on Saturday Night Live, you know, instead of God calling, you know, it's your God is texting me.
Right.
Oh, sorry, Don. Even if there were no metaphysical traditional grounds for believing in a God, men would postulate one simply as a pretext for living hard and getting out of the game of existence its keenest possibilities of zest. In other words, if God doesn't exist, humans will make one anyway, because it gives them, you know, I guess, a reason for living the best life possible.
Around
with the promise of something beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that's right at the very end.
Yeah, around the middle of the essay, he's talking about good and evil don't exist apart from a will, and then he says, if one of the thinkers were obviously divine, while all the others were just human, there would probably be no practical dispute about the matter, of course, because
right.
God would supersede everything. The divine thought would be the model to which the others should conform. So, I mean, at that point, it's just an if, right? But at the very end, did I read this?
Although he follows there the thing, like, if God says so, then it must be so. Remember that argument from before?
Yeah.
He assumes that the decisions of the divine are the right answer.
Yeah, of course, yes.
As opposed to a bad guy.
But at the very end, and this is literally on the last page, maybe I didn't read this, I don't remember. It would seem too, and this is my final conclusion, he says, that the stable and systematic moral universe for which the ethical philosopher asks is fully possible only in a world where there is a divine thinker with all enveloping demands. If such a thinker existed, his way of subordinating the demands to one another would be the finally valid casuistic scale. His claims would be the most appealing. His ideal universe would be the most inclusive, realizable whole. If he now exists, then actualized in his thought already must be that ethical philosophy which we seek as the pattern which our own must evermore approach. In the interests of our own ideal and of systematically unified moral truth, therefore, we, as would-be philosophers, must postulate a divine thinker and pray for the victory of the religious cause. So, I mean, that's where he winds all around, in the but this is where he ends up. Yeah. Jake?
I can't remember if it's that essay, or it could be another essay in this, where he gives what amounts to a rallying cry for inclusivity and toleration. And he goes on. He's on a roll. I'm very impressed.
Uh-huh. Not this one, Jay.
I don't recall where that is.
Sorry.
Off the top of my head. But anyway, sorry. Yeah.
No, that's.
But clearly, this argument is
lots of words.
Is closely connected with the idea of morality. I mean, there are various versions of the moral argument. Kant has a famous version of the moral argument. This is, I think, kind of close to what C.S. Lewis says, I think. I don't remember that much. But all right, let's move on to the last one then, which I've called the mystical argument. And this one will look an awful lot like Plotinus. In fact, I would say that as a metaphysician, William James comes off as a modern-day Neoplatonist, really. And I read you, just before the end of class last time, I read you just about two or three sentences from the essay called Some Hegelisms, where he's contrasting Hegelian, or implied, I guess you'd say, Hegelian metaphysics with the metaphysics that he himself wants to uphold. And in his mind, this is a difference between a monistic system and a pluralistic, a monistic religious system and a pluralistic religious system. You know, later on we'll talk about his, I can't remember if it was a treatise or if it was a series of lectures, a pluralistic universe. You remember, Jay, if it was at a series of lectures or was it a
pluralistic universe.
I know, but was it a series of lectures or was it a book, do you recall?
I
don't remember which it was.
I think it was a series of lectures that he worked into a book.
Oh, yeah, I meant initially is what I meant. Yeah. Oh, like you know, like pragmatism is a series of lectures.
Right. Yes. I don't know if they were.
Yeah, well, anyway, it's interesting, of the six works I'm going over, three of them were lectures originally, you know, because he was very popular. You know, he was on the lecture circuit quite a bit, and he's probably pretty good at it. But the point is that, Hegel's metaphysics is ultimately a religious metaphysics, really. I mean, you can read between the lines of the phenomenology of mind, and you can see how for Hegel, what really is consciousness with a big C, you know, consciousness with a big C. And the phenomenology of mind is nothing more than the history of consciousness. He uses consciousness in the singular all the time. He doesn't say consciousness is. He says consciousness. James wants to contrast his own metaphysical position with that all-embracing consciousness with a capital C. He wants to believe in a universe with spiritual beings, certainly, but not just one of them, but many. And hence, we have this idea of the pluralistic universe. So, that is sort of foreshadowed in that two or three sentences, whatever, I read from Some Hegelisms last time. But the argument doesn't really get into, really start until you get to the last of the essays, which is, I never can remember the whole title, it's got a big long title. What Psychical Research Has Accomplished is what it's called. And so I want to read you, it's actually just a short passage. I thought there were two of them in here, but I guess just one. Here he's quoting from somebody else who has, back in the 19th century, there was a lot of interest among intellectuals in things like mediumship and, stuff like that. Well, anyway, he's quoting from this guy, Myers, and this is what he says. I must close my gossip about the proceedings by naming what, after all, seems to me the most important part of its contents. So this is what psychical research has accomplished, and this is the most important thing that psychical research has come up with, so he claims. This is the long series of articles by Mr. Myers on what he now calls the subliminal self, or what one might designate as ultra-marginal consciousness. The result of Myers' learned and ingenious studies in hypnotism, hallucinations, automatic writing, mediumship, and the whole series of allied phenomena is a conviction which he expresses in the following terms. Now here's a quote from Mr. Myers. Each of us is in reality an abiding psychical entity far more extensive than he knows. An individuality which can never express itself completely through any corporeal manifestation. The self, with a capital S, manifests itself through the organism, but there is always some part of the self unmanifested, and always, as it seems, some power of organic expression in abeyance or in reserve. That's the end of the quote. The gist of it, of course, is then that, well, it's kind of related to the unconscious, right? I mean, we all have an inner world, right? And yet, Myers is saying, well, this inner world that you're aware of is just like the tip of the visible part of the iceberg, as it were. And the majority of the iceberg is under the water, and you don't see it, and you're not even aware of it. And then James goes on. The ordinary consciousness, Mr. Myers likens to the visible part of the solar spectrum. The ordinary consciousness, Mr. Myers likens to the visible part of the solar spectrum. The total consciousness is like that spectrum prolonged by the inclusion of the ultra-red and ultraviolet rays. In the psychic spectrum, the ultra parts may embrace a far wider range, both of physiological and of psychological activity, than it is open to our ordinary consciousness and memory. So, there is this idea of a self with a capital S, which sort of underlies our own selves, which are certainly many different selves. And in that respect, it's very Neoplatonic. You may remember, some of you way on back, I don't have any room to draw anything anymore. I think I can get rid of this. This will have to do. Not perfect, but that's okay. That for Plotinus, we have sort of three levels of reality. We have what he calls the one, and then there is, well, the Greek is nous, so mind, intellect, let's just use the word mind, I guess, and we have soul down here. And actually, though, probably a better picture would be something like this, because, right, and this is the one here, and this is mind here. But at this point, things start splitting apart, right? Not a whole lot, but somewhat. So you have little minds here, right? And then you get down to soul. Well, things are even more diversified at that level. So we have, right, we have your soul, my soul, and all that sort of thing. But they're also all sort of somehow an outgrowths of soul with a capital S, just as these minds or intellects, nooses, are outgrowths of the mind, and all that, all those things are in turn outgrowths of the one. So everything ultimately is connected somehow to this singularity, this first principle that's a singularity. And that seems to be the picture that, James is using here, following this Mr. Myers. It's as though, our consciousness is just a very small part of what constitutes our inner selves, and somehow they're kind of linked at a very deep level, is the idea. So that's why I call it the mystical argument, just because it's very similar to Neoplatonism. So anyway, any comments, questions, or anything?
So he's not talking about things we just do unconsciously, like, when I'm walking down the street, I'm not thinking about how I'm walking, I'm just walking, right?
Yeah.
But he's talking more about your psychological makeup, not, not just that you're not thinking.
Correct. That's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's make sure that. It is interesting that, I mean, I'm quite sure that psychologists have veered off quite a bit from those interests of mediumship and writing and whatever all he was talking about back in the 19th century. And yet, if anything, and the appreciation, I think, of the fact that there's an awful lot going up here that we aren't even aware of has grown. Because of, you know, experiments. I mentioned, didn't I? I don't think I had it quite right. The blindsight experiment. Didn't I mention that in here? Yes. You know, where, I'm not sure I described it right, but it was a case where something was presented to the left eye, which would go to the right brain, and the right brain is not conscious. And then they would ask the person to guess what first comes into your mind. I don't know how they phrased it. And, you know, like 75% of the time they'd get it right, even though they were not aware of this object, this picture out there, which means that there's some process. And, you know, good and well, we've all had the experience, too, of you're trying to think of something, you can't think of it, and 3 hours later, there it is. It pops into your head. Well, how'd that happen? Yeah. Well, there's some background processing going on, no doubt, and you aren't even aware of it, right? Tons of stuff like that. It certainly does seem to be the case that there's a whole huge reservoir of, subjective something or other that is not really associated with our conscious life. So that's interesting.
But Dan?
Yeah?
Do you think in that process that you just mentioned, that it starts to appear more as we age?
Oh.
Did you ever think about that? Did it happen to you, 10 years ago or 15 years ago?
Sure. Oh, you mean did not being able to think about something and then
yeah,
it comes
some,
to
suddenly
you?
Suddenly you say, oh gosh, and you can't come up with that, and then about an hour later, suddenly it appears.
Well,
how on earth couldn't I find it at that moment?
Well, it's certainly true that you slow down as you get older. I mean, your thought processes slow down.
I have never had that before.
Yeah. But
and that is starting to happen once in a while, when the most simple thing, like, who wrote this?
Yeah.
And then you know who wrote it, but you just
yeah.
don't come up with it.
Yeah.
An hour later or so, suddenly you know, oh, yeah, right.
Yeah. That's true.
But language acquisition by children is subconscious for the most part. It's just not as obvious as, I remember something that I forgot. Now I can recall it, right?
Yeah.
But like little kids learning language, they're not consciously learning language for the most part, other than this is a dog.
Yeah,
right?
I know.
I mean, they're absorbing subconsciously most of it.
Right. Right. I think
so. And wouldn't you think?
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. I mean, they're not thinking about it. Oh,
no,
you know, this is a new word, dog. Okay, dog. You know, they don't do that.
Some of that, but not really. Not most of it.
Yes, that's correct. Yeah. But I mean, I think I can remember. I mean, I've always, even when I was in my 20s or whatever, or teens, I would try to, sometimes I would not be able to think of something that I knew I should be able to I knew, and I'd just forget about it for a while, and then, boom, it would come to me. That happens. But maybe
like your girlfriend's name.
Yeah, that's what it is.
Or her birthday.
Oops. No, I've always remembered Patty's birthday. Now, our wedding anniversary. I'm pretty good at it, although I did miss it by one day once. I said it was the 28th, it was the 29th of August. Anyway.
Well, you want to err on the
there
side.
You go. I erred on the correct side. Yes, exactly.
No, Don, you're early. Oh, okay.
All right. So, we're not done with the will to believe, because remember, it's the will to believe. We've talked about belief, but we haven't talked about the will side of it, or at least, I mean, because as I read them, three of the essays deal with determinism. And anti-determinism. And so let's look at that.
But what did he do with this mystical argument?
I'm sorry?
What did he actually? What was the end point of his argument?
The main point is all this is a review of psychical research from around the time when he was writing it. All he says is, well, this is probably the most interesting result of all of this research.
He didn't take it to a conclusion.
But the point I was making, though, when we get to a pluralistic universe, when we get to that work, that will dovetail with what we just heard. That's the idea. So this is kind of where it starts, you might say. Hi.
You good?
Yeah, we're good.
All right, just saying hi.
Yeah.
Good morning.
So, let's talk about the other topic, which is his anti-determinism. And the title of the relevant essay is, no surprise here, The Dilemma of Determinism. So this is, actually there are two major themes here. The first one is his reasons for rejecting determinism. I'm not convinced that his argument is totally convincing, but let's take a look at it. So he says this: we have seen what determinism means. We have seen that the indeterminate is rightly described as meaning chance. And we have seen that chance, the very name of which we are urged to shrink from as from a metaphysical pestilence, means only the negative fact that no part of the world, however big, can claim to control absolutely the destinies of the whole. Okay, fine. So the determinist is very much averse to chance, because it would mean that, you know, that some things just happen and there's no causal reason why. I wish, first of all, to show you just what the notion that this is a deterministic world implies. He's going to come out, of course, against it, as I say. He's going to come out in favor of chance, I guess you would say, or at least favor of free will. So what does determinism imply, he says. The implications I call your attention to are all bound up with the fact that it is a world in which we constantly have to make what I shall, with your permission, call judgments of regret. I think this is a very peculiar way of putting it. But what he means is that, okay, what is, what will be, what has happened, too bad, it's unfortunate, but what can you do? That's the judgments of regret idea. Determinism, in denying that anything else can be in its stead, virtually defines the universe as a place in which what ought to be is impossible. In other words, as an organism whose constitution is afflicted with an incurable taint and irremediable flaw. Because there are going to be some things that just should not be, but there it is. That's where the regrets come in. The only deterministic escape from pessimism is everywhere to abandon the judgment of regret. That this can be done, history shows not to be impossible. The devil may be good, that is, although he be a principle of evil, yet the universe, with such a principle in it, may practically be a better universe than it could be without. On every hand, in a small way, we find that a certain amount of evil is a condition by which a higher form of good is brought. That might be a way of reconciling our regrets with the deterministic universe by saying, well, you know, it is the way it is because a certain amount of bad stuff is necessary in order to have a higher balance of good, say, something like that. Anyway, though, but why should I not be a determinist? Well, does not this immediately bring us into a curious logical predicament, he says. So here's why I should not be a determinist. Here's his main argument for why I should not be a determinist. And as I say, I'm not convinced that this is maybe a knockdown argument. Our determinism leads us to call our judgments of regret wrong, because they are pessimistic in implying that what is impossible yet ought to be. But how then about the judgments of regret themselves? If they are wrong, other judgments, judgments of approval, presumably, ought to be in their place. But as they are necessitated, assuming determinism, as they are necessitated, nothing else can be in their place. And the universe is just what it was before, namely a place in which what ought to be appears impossible. We have got one foot of the out of the pessimistic bog, but the other one sinks all the deeper. We have rescued our actions from the bonds of evil, but our judgments are now held fast. When murders and treacheries cease to be sins, regrets are theoretic, absurdities and errors. The theoretic and the active life thus play a kind of seesaw with each other on the ground of evil. The rise of either sends the other down. Murder and treachery cannot be good without regret being bad. Regret cannot be good without treachery and murder being bad. Both, however, are supposed to have been foredoomed. So something must be fatally unreasonable, absurd, and wrong in the world. It must be a place of which either sin or error forms a necessary part. So his idea here, then, is that, okay, the determinist, in other words, says, well, basically the determinist should say they're just facts out there. I mean, what's the point of saying this is good or this ought to be, you know, this is something that could be better, it ought to be better. What's the point? If it is what it is, and the way it is necessitated, right? And yet, so James says, the determinist is then drawing from that the conclusion that you ought not to regret these things that shouldn't be the way you claim they are. But that's an ought. So where did this ought come from in a purely factual universe? Why are you telling me that I should not ever say, well, this ought to have been otherwise, because you're criticizing me for introducing an ought into a totally factual world, but then you're in turning around and in criticizing me are saying I ought not to be doing that, and therefore you're introducing an ought. So in other words, he claims, determinism then is embroiled in this logical inconsistency, in saying on the one hand that there are no oughts out there, it is what it is, and that's just the way it is, but then on the other hand, saying you ought not to regret things not being the way you think they should be, but in doing that, you're introducing an ought into a world that you've said is nothing but is-es. Where I think that argument is a little bit flaky is that I think a really consistent determinist just would not venture the ought. It venture to say that you ought not to regret, or you ought not to introduce oughts into your understanding of the world. I'm not sure that the determinist is forced to use ought language, but James speaks as though the determinist is forced to use ought language.
I'm a little confused here, Don. Let's take tonight's Super Bowl.
Yeah.
There's a chance that some player will make a terrible mistake that will cost his team the game.
Okay.
You know, it happens. And that person will feel regret.
Right.
I blew it.
Yeah, I know.
For me, myself and millions of others, all right?
Yeah.
And we could be sympathetic. We know that feeling.
Yep,
you sure blew it, missed that kick or whatever.
But
so the determinist would just say, bad things happen, get over it? Or
yeah,
would the determinist say, you ought not to feel bad that you blew that game?
The determinist, to be really consistent, I mean, this is what I'm saying. James seems to be saying that the determinist can't avoid making value judgments. But to be really consistent, you shouldn't be doing that. You know, well, I'm not sure that the determinist can't avoid introducing value judgments.
Right, because the determinist is going to say,
it is what it is.
A pure determinist would say, would say, you shouldn't feel bad because you're the innocent victim.
Well, but if you say shouldn't, then you're introducing values again. So, I mean, a really consistent determinist might just say, well,
that your feelings are a result of chemical reactions in your brain, and that those were predetermined as well,
yeah.
And that's just the way it is.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, yeah, you may think that there are values out there, but there aren't because of what you just said. Yeah.
But that kind of waters down the concept of responsibility.
Yeah.
No, it's if people are going to have that attitude, okay, well, it is what it is.
And yeah.
It's really, it's not going to impulse you to do to prevent something or just to even try to change that the outcome of what it could be.
As a psychological effect, that may be. As a refutation of determinism, though, the Stoics dealt with that problem. The Stoics were thoroughgoing determinists, and one of the objections was, well, then Milo, who was a famous wrestler, will win the wrestling match whether he tries or not. But then the reply is, well, trying is co-determined with winning. So in other words, all these other things you're saying, well, you wouldn't be motivated to do. Well, I'm sorry, but being motivated to do it is co-determined with the eventual outcome. Milo is not going to win the wrestling match unless Milo tries. But if Milo is
predetermined that he would try.
Yeah, exactly. If he's fated to win, he's also fated to try to win. Things are co-fated, in other words. There's a whole web there that's fated at the same time.
That's exactly what I was thinking of Milo too, but it seems like James is using the term determinism in a slightly different way.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the whole thing, as Ruben just said, everything is embedded in a causal matrix, and if that's the case, then whatever happens because of prior causes, and it's just a fact. Even your regrets are really just facts because of chemicals and whatever.
I mean, like, yeah, it's not that you ought not to feel regret, it's that you will feel regret.
Yeah, 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 exactly.
Because this is how humans are,
yes.
Therefore you will.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. You know, it is interesting.
You think about that.
Did the Stoics feel regret?
Exactly.
Was the guy that Milo beat feel regret?
Well, I presume, but I mean, that was fated too, right? Everything is a result of prior causes. In a religious context, next week we're going to talk about predestination, by the way. That's what's coming up. But in a religious context...
Of course! It's already predetermined.
Yeah. We will. But in a religious context, it is interesting how this interplay sometimes, you know, when we're talking about responsibility for sin or whatever, we talk about free will, right? But on the other hand, I keep on going back. Remember I mentioned this the other day. That poor family whose husband was killed and I think some children in the same family after the bombing at the... when all the people were trying to flee Afghanistan.
Oh, yeah.
And then we thought we found a culprit or something, and we, you know, bombed the car. Turned out to be actually somebody who had worked with us, plus part of his family. And they quoted the woman, the wife. And I can't fathom how she could say what she said. She said, well, everybody makes mistakes. But she also, though, said, and this is very prominent in Islam, as I keep on saying, this idea that Allah has the whole thing set up, you know. And if your time is up, it's up. And so in her eyes, I suppose, or in her mind, determinism is a kind of a comfort.
Yeah.
It's all written in that book up there, and God had put the period on her husband's life and on the life of whatever children that were killed, and there's nothing you can do about it. God wills it. End of story. So we have this love-hate relationship in religion. And I mean, Christians do the same thing, but maybe not to that degree. But we have this love-hate relationship with determinism. When we're talking about responsibility for sin and whatnot, we don't like it. But on the other hand, at least certain religious traditions, Calvinism, derive a certain amount of comfort from it. So go figure. Well, I'll end on that note. I know that clock is slow. So
really,
I'm sure it's probably 25 till, right?
It is now. Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Flipped.
Okay. Well, that was. All righty. So, see you all next week.
Are we going to be first?
Why?